Chapter 3. Bodies Growing. Dawns rise high over the cliffs, and green tinges the branches, when her people feel the urge to move again. The Ferd, who live nearby, have grown wary, leave no prince to follow. The tiny body that she pushed herself inside out to birth stayed thin, sucked only weakly. Eventually, it stopped, went rigid like dried tendon. Yet still she carried it, as skin shrank around stick limbs and stretched over shoulder blades. Now, the group gathers things to leave, and she feels the pull to join them. But putting down her burden is frightening. Inhaling her infant's heady birth smell, still caught in its dark hair, she crouches at the shelter edge. The clutched bundle is lowered to the ground, and for the first time lies apart from her body. The others approach curiously, reach out to prod, pull, stroke, to know. Yet beasts will come later, and this precious thing must be protected. She scoops a hollow, slides the already dusty form down, covers it. Embraced by the soft dirt full of their stony leavings, she draws back and joins the people to walk on. Skies flicker as the days, years, centuries pass. Soils condense and hold the delicate bones tight. Others come and go above, but eventually the vibrations of footfalls stop. Even icy tendrils from heart-aching cold cannot penetrate to the tiny skeleton. Tens of thousands more winters, then deep thumpings murmur downwards. The weight lessens. Voices come. New people are building a house where none have lived for so long. Pattern-shod feet clatter up and down wooden stairs over the small remains, a lullaby of life above death. In a blink, the house too is gone. Then sediments shiver and shift as hands pull at the dirt. Clods crumble, and a chink of early summer sunlight grazes the white shatter of eggshell-thin skull. A voice shouts out, "Arrête! Us!" Rough yet gentle hands, like those that last touched this lonely little one, reach down after so long to pick it up. It's the 19th of May, 1914. In the space of a month, a car will take a wrong turn in Sarajevo. A gun will fire, and two aristocratic deaths will snowball into 200 million. On the other side of Europe, in the French Perigord, a life lost 40 millennia earlier comes to light. Denis Peroni's diary for the day's work at the rock shelter of Le Moustier records the discovery of pathetically tiny bones. One of the 20th century's most respected prehistorians, he's relatively unsung today, unlike his younger and flashier colleague, François Bord. Born to a farming family the same decade that the Feldhofer and Gibraltar Neanderthals hit the news, Peroni grew up close to the land. Alongside becoming the Les Aisies village school teacher, he was fascinated by the deep past. By 1894, he had begun collaborating with Louis Capitain, a pathologist turned prehistoric anthropologist, and 7 years later, they discovered the astonishing Ice Age paintings of Font de Gaume. As the spring of 1914 ended, Peroni was a seasoned excavator of Neanderthal sites, including skeletons at the great La Ferassie rock shelter. When remains were uncovered that May at Le Moustier, he immediately recognized them as a very young baby. Miraculously untouched by construction and demolition right above it, the infant now known as Le Moustier II would be lost and found once more over the next 80 years. It's one of many individual Neanderthals with fascinating histories of discovery. All hominin bones, whether fossilized or not, are special. Bodily representatives of lives lived tens or hundreds of millennia ago, their immediacy captivates, but also their rarity. We have millions more artifacts made by Neanderthals than bones from the hands that once touched them. Nonetheless, collectively, we know them more intimately than any of our other close relations. The handful of remains 100 years ago whispering stories of another kind of human have today swelled to thousands of fossils from many, many sites. They represent a couple of hundred individuals, from newborn babies to old adults who, while not decrepit by today's standards, were probably elders in their own society. This rich sample allows us to reconstruct the biological character and diversity of the Neanderthals. Even with such impressive numbers, every skeletal part is still worthy of velvet cushion reverence. They're conserved and transported in locked cases like diamonds or sacred relics. Their priceless value lies in being treasure troves of data on individual lives and simultaneously acting as windows onto entire populations. Specialists apply a vast range of techniques, from biochemistry to high-tech visualizations, examining whole bodies or zooming down to the near daily layers inside teeth. Through the DNA they contain, Neanderthal remains are also our direct connection to these vanished people. We may be twice removed from their dry bones, by time and the glass of museum cases, but encountering them, it's hard not to feel a shiver pass across our own still vital skin. Perhaps especially so when in miniature, a child's life too abruptly ended, no matter how long ago. Growing up, Neanderthal. That any bones at all survive over such immense timescales is astonishing, and even more so the fragile bodies of babies. This is particularly the case at Le Moustier, a rock shelter sited where a pier-like limestone ridge juts out between two valleys. Over more than a century, these cliffs have seen as many theories about Neanderthals swirl around them as floods of the river. Le Moustier has suffered the growing pains of prehistory as a discipline, being found before it was truly understood how excavation both reveals and destroys the archaeological record. All the clever techniques in the world for studying individual artifacts matter little if a site has been emptied without recording a crucial dimension, the patterns telling us where things came from and in which order things happened. Archaeology distinguishes between different parts or features of a site. One level up from individual artifacts is the assemblage, essentially the smallest identifiable grouping of finds that seem to belong together. Typically, assemblages belong to layers, sediment deposits picked out by excavators according to colour, texture, or their archaeological content. The sequence of layers is called the stratigraphy. It's the archive of things that have happened in that place, whether human detritus or naturally accumulated rockfalls, muddy sludges, or windblown dusts. Digging means removing layers, and those lower down will be progressively older. There are often complications. Erosion, localized inversions, or even disturbance by later prehistoric activity. Identifying mixing or movement between layers is crucial, and achieved by carefully examining not just artifacts, but also the soils and spatial relationships between things. To paraphrase Carl Sagan, to understand what Neanderthals were doing at any particular site, you must first reconstruct its entire history of formation. This is taphonomy, today recognised as the most important part of archaeology. Le Moustier had not lain undisturbed between Lachte and Christie's digging and Peyronie's work. A Swiss archaeologist named Otto Hauser was also active in the Périgord, including at Le Moustier from 1907 onwards. By a miracle, neither his attentions nor 18th century building work had disturbed the tiny bones just 25 centimetres or 10 inches below the surface, a hair's breadth in geological terms. We'll return to Hauser later, but after his departure, Peroni took over, finding intact deposits beneath a demolished house. It was here the infant had lain hidden, a ghost under the stairs. Despite having excavated several Neanderthal skeletons already, Peroni recorded virtually no details about the find, beyond asserting the existence of a pit. But he immediately sent the remains to Parisian anatomist Marcel Boule, already an authority on Neanderthals. Just a week later, his opinion was received, confirming that the remains were of a newborn. At this point, incredibly, the skeleton disappears from records. Peroni's journal never mentions it again, and within 2 months, fieldwork was abandoned as the First World War enveloped Europe. It was assumed for many decades that the baby was another casualty, whether lost or destroyed, of the long years of conflict. In fact, some of the remains had been waiting safely, albeit unrecognised, just a few kilometres from the site. In 1913, the year before he had found the skeleton, Peroni founded a magnificent museum in Les Aisies. During an inventory of its vast collections some 80 years later, bones labelled skeleton turned up among the Lemoustier boxes. Clearly those of a single newborn, researchers dared to hope it might be the lost Neanderthal baby, last known to have been in Paris. 6 months of exhaustive analysis revealed that sediments still encasing some of the bones and containing tiny lithic fragments were identical to those from Lemoustier. Some of the skeleton must therefore have stayed behind in the Périgord and over time been somehow forgotten. But what happened to the parts sent to Paris? Their tale was one of mistaken identity. Peroni's attention in 1914 was divided between three Neanderthal sites, all with skeletons. Lemoustier and two other rock shelters, Pêche de l'Azay 1 and La Ferrassie. He was sending much of this to Boule, some still inside sediment blocks to be excavated in the lab. Decades later, it was noticed that two bones from a supposed double infant burial at La Ferrassie were suspiciously different in colour and condition. 20th century analysis confirmed that adhering sediments and the tiny shards of flint they contained matched not those at La Ferrassie, but Lemoustier. What's more, the thigh and upper arm were the exact parts missing from the Lemoustier baby. Boule's laboratory, fairly heaving with unlabeled Neanderthal remains and likely hectic at the war's outbreak, was the perfect setting for them to become confused and wrongly curated with the La Ferrassie infant. This strange meeting of two little lost souls, separated in life by many millennia, continues today, since the Moustier baby's limbs remain in Paris, more than 160 kilometres or 100 miles from the rest of its body. With Neanderthal bones today treated as priceless objects, such a history seems astonishing. But the tiny skeleton's rediscovery wasn't just a happy coda. The tragic inverted existence of fossil infants with vastly longer afterlives than their time under the sun nonetheless offers opportunities. To understand whether Neanderthals physically and cognitively developed as fast as our own children, we need to know what the starting point was. Their fragile remains also remind us that each Neanderthal lifespan was unique and sometimes interrupted on the great path from birth to creaky-jointed old age. Let's meet some Neanderthal youngsters who now rest in museums around the world. The Lemoustier baby would have fitted into any newborn's first outfit. But there are children of many ages. Imagine a group photo. Barely sitting up at the front are 7-month-olds, alongside slightly older crawlers, plus fidgety toddlers and an unruly gang of 3-year-olds. At the back stand children ranging from 4 years up, losing their last babyish features. They come from Spain, France, Israel, Syria, even an 8-year-old from Uzbekistan. Only DNA can identify if children were female or male, but their age can be worked out from teeth and bones. It's this that suggests Neanderthals grew up at a slightly different tempo than Homo sapiens, but in varying ways. Teeth are mostly mineral, making them like proto-fossils that survive decay when bones do not. When researchers count the inner growth lines, known as pericamata, they find that formation rates were, on average, a day faster in Neanderthal children. Similarly, some Neanderthal children lost their milk teeth anywhere up to 1 to 3 years faster. But pericamata and tooth development in others match typical rates today. This is shown by one of the most complete young Neanderthals found in 1961 at Roc de Marsal, a few hours' walk downriver from Le Moustier. Skeletal age estimates came out between 2.5 and 4 years old, but synchrotron radiation microtomography, a type of super intense X-ray scan, found more advanced molars alongside front teeth lagging behind comparably aged children today. A similarly contradictory impression emerges from the body of a young boy from the cave of El Cidron, northwest Spain. His back teeth were less developed than the pericamata implied they should be, and some of his bones looked more like those of a child 2 or 3 years younger. Maybe he was just a tiddly kid, but this all shows how Neanderthals had their own range of variation and complexity in development. Intriguingly, the El Cidron boy's brain was also a bit behind for his apparent age, and understanding this aspect of growing up is especially important. One fact that sticks in people's memory, probably because it's unexpected, is Neanderthals' supposedly larger brains. Lacking any mummified or frozen corpses, we can't examine them directly. However, brains do leave an impression on the inner skull. Once studied by plaster casts, modern scanning technologies recreate them using inverted 3D models. Vanished grey matter reappears in ghostly digital form, even down to a snaking artery that once pulsed with blood. It turns out that their apparently bigger brains are actually due to sex-biased samples. When only males are compared, the difference is much less, highlighting the probability that most complete Neanderthal skeletons belong to men. From birth, their skulls started out pretty similar in size to ours. But had you cradled the Le Moustier baby's downy head, its shape would have felt a little unexpected. Combining scans of this and another newborn's skull shows how the middle parts of their faces were already slightly pulled out, and they lacked the cute chins of our own babies. There's much debate over the way their brains developed during the crucial early years, and some size projections look remarkably like our own, albeit growing slightly faster. Yet the structure itself didn't develop more rapidly. That tells us Neanderthal babies were hitting the magical milestones of smiling, grasping, and babbling at roughly the same time ours do. Small differences eventually add up, though. So physiological childhoods may have finished earlier, leaving less time to learn complex social and technological skills. But what was going on with brains is balanced in other body parts. Bones to bodies. It's quite amazing that, in total, while the remains from less than 0.01% of all Neanderthals who ever lived have made it through the mill of time and taphonomy, they represent somewhere between 200 and 300 individuals. The majority comprise the odd bone or jaw fragment with teeth valiantly holding on. But between 30 to 40 are much more complete skeletons and must have originally entered the dirt whole. We'll consider the debates over burial in chapter 13, but whatever their backstory, each skeleton means a chance to know an individual intimately. And even the bits and pieces are important, helping us explore populations, injury patterns, ages at death, and whether men and women used their bodies differently. One site with an extremely rich fossil record is the Krapina Rock Shelter, Croatia. It produced over 900 bones from somewhere between 20 and 80 individual Neanderthals. However, even based on the lower figure, something like 3/4 of skeletal parts are missing. Undoubtedly, its rapid excavation at the end of the 19th century is part of the reason. Yet, the Site of Spee was found not much before and has far more complete bodies. In fact, many of the Crepina bones were fractured by Neanderthals themselves and probably never deposited as entire skeletons. In contrast, El Cidrón was discovered in 1994, almost a century after Crepina, and is the most abundant Neanderthal fossil locale yet known. Careful excavation recovered over 2,500 remains, but from just 13 Neanderthals. 4 women, 3 men, 3 teenagers, 2 children, and 1 baby. Their bodies had also been broken up, but obviously had originally been more complete. These cases show that no two fossil sites are alike. Interpreting them requires caution, in particular when trying to look at mortality patterns. The age distribution within human populations tends to reflect changing lifetime health risks. There are lots of children, fewer adults, and some old people. But fossils aren't necessarily a mirror image of populations. Just as certain sections of society were excluded from churchyard burials, the archaeological record shows that not all Neanderthals were equally likely to be preserved. And this varies for every site. Bearing that in mind, what we have is still incredibly diverse and enough to mean that our understanding of what they were made of, literally and figuratively, is quite exhaustive. More than ever, we can reconstruct what made them different to us, and even how they experienced the world. Stand face to face with a Neanderthal, and they'd be recognisable as a kind of human, but decidedly unconventional. Somewhat shorter than average, with broader chests and wider waists, their limb proportions were also slightly different. Beneath massively muscled thighs were thicker, rounder, and slightly curved leg bones. Nonetheless, unlike countless inaccurate reconstructions, they absolutely walked as upright as us. Zoom in, and almost everywhere there are anatomical idiosyncrasies, some more obvious, others subtle. As a member of Homo sapiens, you're your own handy anatomical model. Pinch your chin, and under wobbly flesh and muscle, you'll feel a bony core. Nearly all Neanderthals lacked this, even as babies. Feel your head. It's tall, but globular. Your face is short and tucked under the forehead. Though they shared our massively inflated brains relative to other hominins, Neanderthal skulls are shaped very differently. Lower crowns gave them a more aerodynamic, sculpted look, finished by an obvious bump just above the neck. This is known as the occipital bun. Larger and deeper set eyes gazed out from a face whose nose and mouth seemed pulled forwards, but with swept back cheekbones. Framing all this were magnificent arched brow ridges, not centrally separated like your brows, and much more imposing. But the brain inside, controlling those eyes staring intently back at you, was just as big and deliberating as your own. The differences go beyond the surface. Feel where your jaw meets your head and pretend to chew. This moving joint in Neanderthals was shaped quite differently, with a shallow asymmetric gap and an extra bulge of bone. Slide your tongue to the back of your mouth where your wisdom teeth are, or were. Most Homo sapiens' teeth go up against the jaw arch, but in Neanderthals they're pulled further forwards, creating a gap. Perhaps they could wriggle their tongue into that space, and they would also have felt the slightly curled back edges of their large front teeth with a shovel-like shape. Inside their jaw, their back teeth were different too, often with massive, fused roots. Even newborns' tooth buds are distinctive enough to identify them in the absence of other bones. Reach out in greeting, and you'd see that while your thumb tip is shorter than the second bone, in Neanderthals, even infants, both are nearly the same length. and the hand that clasps yours in an emphatically firm grip is wider, with more flared fingertips. The panoply of variants across their bodies isn't, however, an indication of being more primitive in the widely understood sense. Both we and they inherited some ancient features in common, but their lineage kept others we lost, while the reverse is also true. It's more that Neanderthals and Homo sapiens reflect two diverging pathways of being human, each with their own oddities. The narrow chests, features of the inner ear or teeth that are unique to us, are just as weird as Neanderthals' foibles in the broader context of hominin evolution. Nonetheless, explaining why these differences exist and what they meant for how Neanderthals lived has remained a key focus of research. Our inquisitive minds love to discover reasons for everything. But in fact, evolution via natural selection is simply about reproductive success, not forging an uber adaptation. Explanations for Neanderthal biology often focus on possible advantages, but the reality is more complex, with multiple influences at work. Building bodies is an interconnected process, and altering one part can cause transformation elsewhere. Genetic mutations are just random copying errors and can sometimes result in anatomical features that, if they don't negatively affect survival, persist in small isolated populations. While a genetic blueprint is extremely important, how hominins live also profoundly impacts bodies, from bones right down to the cellular level. The surrounding environment and regular activities can both leave permanent traces. Think how extreme athletes' muscles over time can change their skeleton. Untangling the influence of genetics versus behaviour is crucial for our understanding of Neanderthal anatomy and lifeways. For example, were the differences in limb lengths inherent, due to use, or both? This is why Neanderthal babies and children are so important, as well as those in the awkward teenage years. One particular individual who helps us understand this second developmental period of life has an especially compelling story. The first skeleton found at Le Moustier. Ice to fire. After Lachte and Christie's 1860s excavations at the Upper Rock Shelter, the cliffs lay quiet until the early 20th century, when two of the more bizarre Neanderthal afterlife tales began. One was the baby from Peroni's work, which is officially known as Le Moustier II because another individual had already been found 6 years before. This Le Moustier I skeleton was also swept up in the tides of war and for decades also believed destroyed, but originally found by Otto Hauser, not Peroni. He began digging the large lower shelter in 1907, working between the buildings. It wasn't until the following spring that a spade wielded by Jean Lesalle bit down through thick lower leg bones, and unlike Le Moustier II, which remained hidden, there is a far more detailed record of what they found. Over several days, more bones emerged until, on a rainy night, the skull was uncovered. It took several months, however, before everything was removed. The delay led to claims Hauser was staging things for wealthy visitors, but in fact, the motivation, together with covering and re-excavating the bones, may have been to ensure the remains were protected and witnessed by experts. Hauser had picked Hermann Klatsch, an anthropology professor and a world expert on Neanderthals, for the team, and invited international scholars to attend the final raising on the 12th of August. However, only German colleagues turned up. It largely fell to Klatsch to remove the bones as Hauser took photographs, a unique archive for the time. After attempted reconstructions of the skull in front of the village cafe while children watched, all the remains were securely nailed in a wardrobe before being boxed up and sent to Germany. Thus began nearly a century of extraordinary travels. Hauser had arranged a lucrative sale to the Berlin Museum of Ethnography, where for decades the skeleton was displayed as a prize object. That repose ended early in the Second World War when, as an irreplaceable treasure, it was secreted within a massive bunker in the Zoo Flak Tower, one of several fortified structures housing anti-aircraft systems and a vast air raid shelter. It also functioned as secure storage for priceless cultural materials. Towards the end of the war, the Nazis tried to shift the hoard, and some things made it out, but much did not. As Berlin fell in May 1945, the Zoo Tower hosted a last stand and suffered heavy bombardment, together with the remaining animals of the zoological gardens. Only a few hundred beasts out of thousands survived, and alongside the Neanderthal, in the tower's darkness, a strange Pleistocene rearguard, lions, hyenas, an elephant, and a hippopotamus were left waiting for the Red Army. Ravaging the city, the Soviet Trophy Commission also looted nearly 2 million objects from the Flak Towers and elsewhere across Germany. At some point, the Le Moustier 1 skull was carried off on another train, stacked alongside old masters and golden treasures from Troy, all headed for Moscow. Over a decade afterwards, from behind the Iron Curtain, the skull returned to Berlin. Its Russian sojourn had protected it, but the rest of Le Moustier 1 left behind hadn't been so lucky. Shortly before the war's end, over 2,000 Allied aircraft had begun a massive bombardment, devastating the museum where, incredibly, the skeleton had still been on display. The headless body must have lain there as the walls shook and were engulfed by the inferno. It became buried for a second time, lost among a vast mass of rubble and melted artifacts, until the whole mess was painstakingly excavated 10 years later. But it took another 3 decades for reunification. Returned war booty was in disarray, and the skull was only recognised with meticulous cross-referencing of old photos and catalogues. After the Berlin Wall was torn down, restoring sundered families and friends, in 1991, Le Moustier 1's remains finally came together once more. Scientific pilgrims began arriving to study this famous relic. And 99 years after its original discovery, the first definitive study of Le Moustier 1 was finally published. Probably a boy, aged between 11 and 15 years of age, he's the most complete adolescent Neanderthal known. His skull had the classic long, narrow form, its widest point towards the back, but he looks to have been in the middle of growth spurts. His face was expanding faster upwards than forwards, so he lacked the distinctive space behind his wisdom teeth. And neither his brow ridges nor nose were as imposing as an adult's. Thanks to Le Moustier 1, we know that Neanderthal teenagers had their own awkward teenage phase. Perhaps excesses of hormones meant he was also prone to spots and a quick temper. As if being shuttled across Europe, bombed and burned was not enough. His skull had endured 5 physical restorations, some more gentle than others. But 21st century tech allowed a more accurate virtual effort, using a mirror image to de-skew parts warped from sediment pressure. The result revealed a face that, while still immature, was already dominated by huge eye sockets and looks quite different to any living teenager. Interestingly, though, his brain was already comparatively large, so he may have ended up a particularly large adult. A last mystery remains. At some point between the war's end and the reuniting of the skeleton in the 1990s, a front tooth and some facial bones went missing. Did this happen in Berlin as the muddled war booty was unpacked again? Or perhaps earlier, when crates from the Zoo Tower were opened somewhere in the Soviet Union? One might imagine the skull being damaged as it was assessed by soldiers surrounded by bullion and oil paintings. We'll never know, though the idea of a lost Neanderthal tooth still lying in the darkness of a Russian salt mine is rather enchanting. Faces and senses. Neanderthal skulls are captivating, but even without warping, the complex functions of their structures are hard to reconstruct. In general, unpicking the reasons for anatomical differences between them and us is an enormous can of worms. Skull geometry intersects in complex ways, and researchers are only just beginning to understand the genetics and biochemistry behind bone growth. Probably, some of the overall skull shape is down to random drift in genes over thousands of generations, but it's always features that might have had evolutionary advantages that grab attention, particularly in an Ice Age world. However, these days, the dominance of glacial conditions as drivers of their physical evolution is far less obvious. Instead, their bodies may have been moulded in large part by how they lived. Starting at the top of the body, we can explore how ideas have altered. Explanations for those huge brows have ranged from structural support for the big face to acting as natural sun visors. One recent, slightly left-field theory claims that Neanderthals relied on them to communicate, in a similar way to baboons signalling status by waggling brightly coloured brows. But modelling revealed that massive bony ridges actually make that harder, and chimpanzees show that there's plenty of other ways to convey meaning with the face and body. Next come the eyes. Just how did Neanderthals see the world? Their sockets were larger than any Homo sapiens, past or present, and bigger eyes potentially mean more photo-absorbing retina and greater light sensitivity. Why would they need this? Assuming Neanderthal heartlands lay in Western Eurasia, this region is at a much higher latitude than most of the African continent, dealing with less light and especially dim winters. Northerly animals do tend to have bigger eyes, and on average, even people from higher latitudes have eyeballs up to 20% bigger than those from near the equator. Expanded eyes would require a larger visual system, and this area, housed in the distinctive occipital bun, is clearly bigger in Neanderthals. Better vision in low light conditions might have usefully extended the day. It could have left less computational capacity for other things. The frontal cortex in particular deals with social interactions, and its size seems connected to larger social networks. Our own brains are particularly inflated in this area compared to Neanderthals. But on the other hand, minds are famously flexible, physically adapting after serious injuries by shifting tasks between zones, and even growing new tissue in frequently used areas. Without directly observing Neanderthals in an MRI scanner, it's hard to be certain if their big eyes and greater visual neuron volumes held back other cognitive and social capacity. Whether or not they had owl-like vision, Neanderthals probably shared our weird, among apes, white eyeballs, and palette of iris colours. Reconstructing individuals' pigmentation, however, whether in eyes, hair, or skin, is surprisingly tricky. Many genes are involved, interacting in different ways to produce a fiendish number of combinations. Similar to our own evolutionary history, very dark-skinned Neanderthals are unlikely because, even with continuous sun exposure, getting enough vitamin D at the higher latitudes they lived in would be impossible. Neanderthals therefore very probably developed lighter colouring, but DNA shows it wasn't identical to the various biological mechanisms operating in people today with Eurasian ancestry. Basic genetic comparisons indicate that the combination of red hair and freckles is possible in some Neanderthal individuals, but we can't be totally sure those genes were expressed exactly the same as in us. What's clear, though, is that their population was also diverse. The ginger freckle marker is found in some Spanish and Italian Neanderthals, whereas other analysis indicates that individuals from Croatia had darker skin, eyes, and hair. Whatever the colour of their eyes that gazed at herds on the horizon, paying attention to the auditory world was just as crucial to survival. High-resolution bone scanning technology shows that Neanderthals' tiny inner ear bones and soft tissues beyond neither mirrored ours nor the common ancestral form. Could Neanderthals have heard differently? Surprisingly, functional modelling suggests that these parts still transferred and amplified sound waves exactly as in your own ears. Evolution seems to have adjusted their shape in parallel with changes to the skull, while keeping them tuned into the same sorts of sounds as us. And there's a fair amount of evidence that for humans, to a large extent, this means sounds we make using vocal communication. If their vision was perhaps more acute and their hearing just as sensitive to voices carried on the breeze, what was their experience of smell? In 2015, a perfume called Neanderthal was released, claiming to be inspired by the hot flint aroma produced from making stone tools. Remarkably, this isn't just sales speak. Napping flints does produce a distinctive scent. It's often compared to a fired gun, and is exactly how astronauts described the smell of moon dust. Around half of the talcum-fine lunar surface is asteroid-pulverized silica, the main ingredient in flint, quartz, and other commonly napped rocks. Strange to think that moon tang would have been more familiar to a Neanderthal than to Neil Armstrong. However, while Neanderthal visual systems were enlarged compared to ours, their olfactory bulb, the brain region that deals with scent, was reduced. Interpreting that as lesser sensitivity, however, requires caution, and it's here that once again genetics comes in. Though not identical, there's clearly some overlap in scent detection genes between us and Neanderthals. One molecule, androstenone, is intriguing. It contributes to the perfume of human sweat and urine, and among the roughly 50% of living people who can detect it, strong dislike is one reaction. If some Neanderthals could also detect this odour, maybe it had a useful function. Androstenone affects hormones and emotions in people, but it's also given off by wild boar, and smelling the porcine version has a dramatic effect on dogs. Perhaps it's involved with hunting, being able to smell a herd over the hill or detect that an animal had passed by would have had strong advantages. Whatever the specifics of particular odours, though, Neanderthals very likely experienced smells, pine resin, horse sweat, old smoke, as a strong trigger for memory. Sucking in scent through their prodigiously sized noses raises the question of why they were so huge. Massive nasal apertures dominate the middle of their faces, and in the flesh, they'd have had a hyped-up King Charles II-esque profile. Microscopic study of their skulls found comparatively huge numbers of bone growth cells in the midface, showing how much the whole area was pushed forwards. Biomechanical models, however, don't support theories that this snouty face gave increased strength for intense chewing, although the next chapter will discuss how they definitely used their teeth for more than eating. In contrast, the smaller, tucked under appearance of our faces are caused by bone-absorbing cells, and unexpectedly, we actually have a stronger bite. The nose itself functions just as much for respiration as for smell. Modelling of nostril airflow in Neanderthals reconstructed the soft tissue for the skeleton from La Chapelle-aux-Saints, France, confirming that the entire setup was nearly a third larger than living humans. In general, one function of the nose is to condition air by warming and moistening it before it reaches our sensitive lungs. That can be especially important in arid and cold conditions, and in some ways, Neanderthals' large internal nasal structures resemble reindeer and saiga antelope, which have extensive mucous membranes to reduce dehydration and heat loss. Fascinatingly, though, the internal structures in Neanderthals appear to be worse at air conditioning than our own, though better than Homo heidelbergensis. What those cavernous nostrils could do, however, was control airflow, allowing Neanderthals to snort in air at almost twice the rate we can. Well over 150 years of staring at Neanderthal remains at increasingly minute scales means we know an astonishing amount about them, sometimes in mind-boggling detail. Tracing how they grew, developed, and sensed the world finds remarkable congruence with ourselves. Blinking against the low glare of winter sun, keeping an ear open for the sound of children playing, or wrinkling noses against wood smoke, were shared experiences of humanity across the millennia. Nevertheless, Neanderthals were different anatomically, in a multiplicity of ways. Interpreting features large and small across their bodies means rethinking evidence for evolutionary adaptations to their very particular world. We're still unravelling the functions of things like bigger eyes, but other aspects, such as noses, may be much less to do with Arctic-ready adaptations than once believed. Instead, running a fuel-hungry body with a high-impact lifestyle may have been the biggest survival challenge they faced.